Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, we're looking at the consequences of some of the actions taken by President Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE. And we begin in Letcher County. There's a historical marker on Route 119, 4 miles south of Whitesburg. It's there to remind all who pass by of what happened at the Scotia coal mine at about 11:45 a.m. on March 9, 1976. An explosion took the lives of 15 miners. And then 2 days later, on the 11th, there was a second underground explosion.
We have bad news. At 12:07, the mine rescue team got to the people, and they're all 11 dead.
In all, 26 Kentucky coal miners were killed by back-to-back explosions caused by coal dust and gases. As a result, Congress created the Mine Safety and Health Administration as part of the Mine Safety Act of 1977. Today, 49 years after the Scotia mine disaster, the Trump administration, through its Department of Government Efficiency, has flagged 33 field offices of the Mine Safety and Health Administration for lease cancellations. 7 of those offices are in Kentucky. The closures come even as President Trump just signed 4 executive actions aimed at boosting coal production. The Appalachian Citizens Law Center has compiled and analyzed data from the Federal Mine Data Retrieval System on the number of inspections conducted and the hours worked by inspectors at these offices. And Law Center Executive Director Wes Addington joins us from Whitesburg to share those findings. Welcome, Wes.
Glad to be here.
So what has happened to the frequency of mining fatalities and injuries in the decades since the Mine Safety and Health Administration was established?
The short answer is they've dropped precipitously. In the United States, you know, we've mined coal for over a century, and for most of that time, we had killed miners in this country in droves. Once some of those large mine disasters became more ingrained in the consciousness of the country, more action was taken to prevent them. So you had the Farmington disaster in 1968, which led to the Coal Act, and then the Scotia mine disaster here in Letcher County in 1976, which led to the Mine Act, which created the Mine Safety and Health Administration, which is not only designed to reduce injuries, reduce fatalities in the mining industry, but also you have the component of health. So, you know, coal mining is different from even a lot of other types of blue-collar jobs, where not only can it be incredibly unsafe and it's ultra-hazardous. So, you know, depending on what happens at work that day will determine whether you come home. But also, you're working in an atmosphere that can be very unhealthy, too. So it can have long-term health impacts for miners if they're overexposed to too much dust. And so MSHA, as it's known, was created to prevent a lot of these issues that miners were faced with from, you know, working in mining, and reduce the risk of injury and death and developing black lung as you, you know, continue to work in your mining career.
Well, tell us what you found in that analysis of the information in the Federal Mine Data Retrieval System.
What we found was that over the course of 2024 and the first 2 months of 2025, among these offices around the country that are slated for closure, there was nearly 17,000 inspections at mines performed that totaled nearly 400,000 hours that inspectors are working on these inspections. So it's a significant amount of work that's happening in these offices to protect miners, to ensure that they have a safe workplace. And unfortunately, as it applies to Kentucky, 7 of those offices are in Kentucky. And it actually is a little worse than even that number, in that the 2 major offices in Kentucky, which are located in Western Kentucky in Madisonville, in Eastern Kentucky in Barbourville, are also slated for closure. I mean, it would only leave offices in Pikeville and Lexington, and the Pikeville office is no longer part of the district in Kentucky and is actually ran out of a district in Virginia now.
So really, just one?
Yeah, I mean, really, what you're doing is it's affecting. And what's unusual about this is it's not being applied in the same way to all states. So it's not really clear, you know, what the thought process was or the analysis in making these huge cuts. It is affecting Kentucky much more severely than, so for example, West Virginia. So many of their offices are not slated for closure. But the reality is that underground coal mines have to be inspected four times a year, surface mines twice a year. And these offices are the locations in which inspectors work out of to do these inspections all over Kentucky. If they no longer exist, it's not clear how you comply with that requirement. And if that requirement's not being met, what we know from more than a century of mining is when you don't have inspectors on site and underground and at these mines regularly, many coal companies start cutting corners. They start trying to mine more coal more quickly. And what that leads to is increased risk of injury. And it certainly increases the likelihood of those injuries causing death. And then also increases the likelihood that something very serious could go wrong and you have a mining disaster where you have multiple fatalities at the same time.
Well, if you hear that all these offices are being closed, you might conclude that somebody decided that mine safety must have improved so much that fewer inspectors are needed to make sure that working miners are safe.
Well, the reason mine safety has improved in this country is because of the apparatus that was created out of the Scotia mine disaster. I mean, you know, we kind of learned our lesson 50 years ago. And that these operations couldn't by themselves self-regulate and keep their workers safe. There's just too many miners were dying. We create that agency and we go from, in 1968, one in 432 miners in that year died on the job to 1977. You know, there was some laws put on the books, improvements in safety were made in 77. It was better. It wasn't good, but it was better. One in 1,700 miners died on the job. But after MSHA was created, those inspections increased. And mining, although still ultra-hazardous, I mean, there's no denying that we're not in a place in this country where we can claim that it's a safe workplace in every coal mine. We're just not there. It doesn't mean that we couldn't get there, but we're not. But it improved so much that by 2019, only one in 6,700 miners died on the job that year. So wildly successful increases in the safety of miners going to work every day. But miners still die on the job. And it's not hard to look at numbers like that and correctly wonder if we stop those inspections, if we stop having a government presence in these workplaces, will many of these operations revert to unsafe practices? And in a highly competitive industry like coal mining that has through a number of external factors like the, you know, price of gas been squeezed and the industry kind of decimated by it, the remaining operators are going to try to mine as much coal as they can as fast as they can. And even some with the best intentions to keep their workers safe, if they're competing against operations that are much more reckless, it creates all the wrong incentives and puts us in a place where miners are just at risk.
Well, these closures of these offices are coming right at the same time as the Mine Safety and Health Administration is taking on the responsibility for monitoring and controlling the silica dust in mines that's contributing to this surge in cases of a new form of black lung. What can you tell us about that?
That's the other factor that I previously mentioned that miners have to worry about in the workplace, which is the amount of coal mine dust that they have to breathe. And unlike our successes in reducing the number of injuries and fatalities in the United States. Although these laws that we previously mentioned in the late 60s and 1977 started reducing the cases of black lung that we saw in the U.S., that all shifted about 25 years ago. And part of the reason for that was conditions. All the good coal seams are gone. So what's left that you're mining are much smaller seams that are interspersed with more seams of rock. Mining rock along with the coal is much more deadly to your health than just the coal itself. You can get silicosis. It leads to more progressive disease, more extensive disease. And all of this is to say we were already in a position in the United States where miners, particularly in Appalachia, are getting more severe disease than their fathers and their grandfathers. And to address that, last year, the Mine Safety and Health Administration promulgated a rule to reduce the amount of silica dust that miners have to breathe. NIOSH, which is the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, it had proposed reducing how much silica miners breathe for more than 30 years. Well, they finally worked on that issue and created a rule that would help miners. It would save some lives. And what has happened is twofold. One, MSHA announced that they are postponing implementation of the rule, which is going to go into effect in April for 4 months. Well, you know, we don't know the particulars of that. We don't know what's ultimately going to come of it. But one of the issues that's also happening in conjunction with this is NIOSH has had huge cuts as part of the efforts of DOGE. And the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program, which is older than I am, which was created in 1970 with the whole idea of monitoring miners' health as they work in mining. You know, you would have a miner that, let's say, he's worked 10 years in mining. We want to look at his X-ray. We'll see if this miner is showing some early stages of black lung. And if that miner is diagnosed with black lung, well, then the law allows that miner to work in a less dusty location in the mine or even outside the mine. That's one of the rights that miners now have in this country. Unfortunately, that surveillance program, which in addition to dealing with working miners with black lung, also had a mobile surveillance van that they took all over the country. It's been all over Eastern Kentucky. I mean, I'm sure listeners have seen it in, you know, a Walmart parking lot in Pikeville, for example. And what that mobile surveillance van did was take the capability to do a chest X-ray, to do a pulmonary function test out in the coal fields to miners, to retired miners. They extended it to miners that have left the industry to monitor them, to accumulate the data that then told us about 20 years ago, there were these hot spots in Appalachia, black lung. And then again, told us about a decade ago that these hot spots had now developed into these areas in which miners were getting progressive massive fibrosis, which, by the way, a lot of industrialized countries around the world had it completely eliminated, that mine coal. The United States is an outlier in that regard. We overexpose our coal miners to more dust than other countries do. That's just a fact.
And has that mobile monitoring been stopped?
It has. So the entire Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program, there's only a few employees that are even left on staff at this point. All of their activities have been shuttered. One of the things that affects not only working miners, but retired miners and their families is NIOSH administers what's called the B-Reader test and program. And a B-Reader is a physician, quite often radiologist, who gets additional training to read for black lung. The term B-Reader, your listeners that have been involved in mining will know that term because they likely have had themselves or a family member have a B reading of their chest X-ray for coworkers' pneumoconiosis or black lung. They administered that program. They tested doctors all over the country and internationally to read these X-rays. Recently, one of the universities that does the tests for the physicians completed one of those tests. There's no one to grade the tests. They've been either shuttered or told not to do any more work at the co-workers health surveillance program in NIOSH. There's implications for not only working miners, but like I said, retired miners and their families throughout the coal fields in a myriad number of ways, whether it's a miner filing a federal black lung claim, whether it's a miner trying to get treatment for their black lung, whether it's a working miner that's facing some unsafe condition at their mine and wants to go to their local MSHA office to talk to an inspector, to raise a complaint, to ask a question, to notify them that I have black lung and I'd like to be in less dust so I don't develop, you know, worsening black lung that can lead to an early death. All of these things are impacted by these closures and essentially shuttering the programs that so many miners and their families rely upon. The point that I want to make is that, you know, people may hear this and just think, well, you know, we don't have as much coal mining in this country anymore. And really, the story is about coal miners. And, you know, the work that we do here, you know, what you quickly realize, it's not just the miners. It's the miners' family. It's the miners' extended family. It's their neighbors. If you have to witness someone that's younger than I am in their early 40s, let's say, develop serious lung disease from working in a coal mine and watch the progression of that disease, and ultimately their early demise and their inability then to support their family. It's a pretty harrowing experience for a lot of these families, and it sticks with people. And all of that's to say that the shuttering of these programs and these agency locations, and in some ways, entire agency offices, will only make the likelihood of that experience increase in a country that knows how to prevent all of this. We can have safe coal mines, and we certainly can prevent miners from developing black lung. We've known how to do that for a very long time. And all of these actions are just going in a direction that's incredibly disturbing to me.
Well, Wes, have you communicated these concerns to Congressman Hal Rogers? You know, his district, the 5th District, does encompass the Kentucky coal fields.
We have. Our organization frequently reaches out to their office on a number of issues, and we have both called and emailed and shared our report about these MSHA closures with their office, but we have yet to receive a response.
So where do you take these concerns from here?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, what we're looking at is getting as much information as we can out to the public based on what we're seeing within our work, then trying to generate some advocacy around these issues, because I know there's a lot of people listening that do care about what happens in the coal fields. And then, you know, we are a nonprofit law firm, so we'll look at if there's legal avenues that we can take to either slow down or prevent some of these things that are happening.
That's Appalachian Citizens Law Center Executive Director Wes Addington in Whitesburg. Thank you so much, Wes.
Thank you.
The FEMA program, BRIC, which stands for Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities, has been helping Kentucky communities get better prepared to withstand extreme weather events like floods or tornadoes or wildfires. Reporters at GRIST recently came into possession of an internal FEMA memo on plans to end the BRIC program. Zoya Tierstein is one of those reporters. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Zoya.
Glad to be here.
And if you would first just tell us more about this BRIC program, what is it? What does it do?
BRIC is FEMA's largest climate adaptation program, sort of a check writing org that helps communities dig out after disaster hits. But more and more over the past several years, as disasters have gotten more intense and incurred larger damages, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of damage over the past 5 years, FEMA has now sort of pivoted to funding communities who were interested in preparing for those disasters before they hit. BRIC was FEMA's flagship program for that. And what's happening now is that FEMA is winding down that program and potentially even targeting grants that have already been promised to states.
Do I take it that the idea was if we invest in these preventive measures now, the cost of the disaster itself and cleaning up after it might be reduced?
That's exactly right. And evidence shows that it's extremely cost effective to prepare as opposed to react. There are various estimates that show, you know, it's like a $6 savings for every dollar invested overall. And then if you update your building codes, for example, which is one of the things that BRIC helps with, it has an $11 savings for every dollar invested. So it's really smart. So the way BRIC works is communities that have had a major disaster declared for their area in the past few years are able to apply for this program, meaning that they've already sort of seen where their vulnerabilities lie. And they now need to, you know, get money to patch those holes and figure out how do we get prepared for the next big thing, because obviously disasters aren't really going anywhere. We're having, you know, more and more intense impacts every year, depending on your area. And so that's really the point of the program is, well, it's more cost effective to fund these communities ahead of time. Let's get this money out the door and get communities to match some percent of that funding so that there's stakeholders on sort of both sides.
So this actually is a program that got started in the first Trump administration, and now evidently they want to shut it down. Has there been an explanation?
Yeah, that's right. So it was launched under Trump in 2020 and sort of approved in 2018. FEMA told us in a statement that BRIC was yet another example of a wasteful and ineffective FEMA program. The agency said it was more concerned with climate change than helping Americans affected by natural disasters. That's referring to the BRIC program that was more concerned with climate change. And so you can see the inherent fallacy there, which is sort of separating climate change from a program aimed at helping Americans prepare for disasters that are getting worse due to, in part, climate change. The explanation, I think, is more systematic, really, that this administration is sort of moving away from mitigation and trying to change FEMA into more of a reactive organization. So less prevention, more immediate consequences.
You touched on this earlier, but I want to go back to it. Are there situations where FEMA has awarded grants under this program, promised funds, which the recipient then figures into their planning, and now those funds will not be coming after all, or maybe are even being clawed back?
Yeah, FEMA aims to cancel any grants and really any BRIC funding writ large that has not been paid out yet by the federal government. That's according to a memo that the Trump administration, who is serving as FEMA administrator right now, Cameron Hamilton, put out to employees recently. So it's tough to say how much of that can get clawed back. A lot of that money is already out the door, and I think states and communities and tribes are struggling to figure out where do we go from here? How do we get this money back out to where it came from? That's going to be a really tricky and thorny issue.
How does this affect the stability of a program on the receiving end of an organization that's expecting this money?
It's very difficult for communities who especially have, you know, few resources to dedicate to this issue. Federal funding largely is what is helping many, many communities across the country prepare for the natural disasters that are becoming more frequent. And in the absence of funding, it's unlikely that many, many of those programs can continue.
Zoya Tierstein is a staff writer at GRIST, where she covers the impacts of climate change on human health. We requested comment on these closures from Congressman Hal Rogers, whose district represents the people of the Eastern Kentucky coal fields. There's been no response. ProPublica is reporting that the Environmental Protection Agency is planning to eliminate longstanding requirements for polluting industries to collect and report their emissions of the heat-trapping gases that cause climate change. The move has been ordered by a Trump appointee and, according to the report, would affect thousands of industrial facilities across the country, including coal mines, but also oil refineries, power plants, and plants that make petrochemicals, cement, glass, iron, and steel. Coming up after the break, defining DEI, CRT, and wokeism, and with the dismantling of the Department of Education, concerns about the future of NAEP, the nation's report card.
It's a canary in a coal mine, if you will, for understanding how our kids are doing.
Also, an effort to encourage and boost Kentucky's next generation of authors and poets. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The WEKU app is redesigned and totally updated. We've made it easier to play the live streams of WEKU and WEKU Classical. You can also find WEKU podcasts and NPR podcasts all in one place. There's more information on what's playing on WEKU Classical. The updated WEKU app is available in the Apple App Store and on Google Play.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. With over $1 billion in annual federal funding on the line, Kentucky school districts have been notified by the State Department of Education that it has eliminated all diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives from public schools. And districts had until April 18th to sign a letter to the U.S. Department of Education confirming that they had done that. Why is DEI so controversial? Roughly half of us believe that by prioritizing diversity in hiring and college admissions, DEI gives historically disadvantaged groups, particularly communities of color, greater access to opportunities. The other half of us believes talent and qualifications have been overlooked in favor of meeting diversity targets, and that the most qualified candidate should always be chosen for the job, regardless of race, ethnicity, or gender. And right now, that side has the upper hand. We hope to hear more about this point of view soon. Speaking in support of the belief that DEI is needed to level the playing field and about what's at stake as these programs are being terminated is Roger Cleveland. Dr. Cleveland has taught diversity, equity, culture, humility, and academic innovation at Morehead, UK, Middle Tennessee, KSU, and here at Eastern. He's chaired the board of the Black Males Working Academy, which focuses on college and career readiness through academics, social emotional learning, and leadership for African American males grades K through 12. You'll find the name Roger Cleveland in the Kentucky Civil Rights Hall of Fame. And he's the guest of Eastern Standard contributor Gerald Smith.
Dr. Cleveland, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Dr. Smith, thanks for the invite.
Listen, I want to, begin the interview by defining some of the terms that we've heard nationwide for several years now, terms that might be familiar to folks such as critical race theory, wokeism, and, of course, DEI. So let's begin the interview by just taking a moment, if you would, to define those terms.
Well, I'll start with DEI because I think all those others are kind of tied to that, particularly wokeism and things of that nature. I know many people will just say DEI, but we have to break that out into diversity, equity, and inclusion. And simply put, diversity is all about differences. And I tell people quite a bit that difference does not denote deficit. It just means difference. And so it could be diversity in reference to ethnicity, gender, religion, culture, educational level, diversity in thought, diversity in perspective. And so it's really just about differences. Equity is about access and providing people addressing their needs. Equity is about justice and fairness. Why someone have a problem with that, I have no idea. And I try to help people understand what I mean by equity. And I use the analogy of during the pandemic and how the pandemic impacted people in different ways. But imagine all of us are, there's five or six of us in the middle of the ocean, in the midst of a storm. Even though we're all in a storm together, we are situated differently. So one person may be in a huge ocean liner, so the storm is bothering them a little bit. Another person may be in a yacht, so it's impacted them even more. And another person may be in a rowboat, so it's really impacting them. Another person may be on a life raft. They're feeling it worse than the person that's an ocean liner, and the last person's on a life preserver. So even though we're all in the same storm, we're situated differently. And you don't apply universal strategies for different situations. You give people what they need, and that's equity. So it's about justice, access, and fairness. Inclusion is really simple, is that you're accepted, not tolerated, whether it's in the workplace or any other place that you feel included, you have voice, you have choice, and you're accepted. Critical race theory is really just a framework for research that a lot of the situations that are in the United States is grounded in issues of race. And so even when that came up in K-12 situations, very few classroom teachers or principals were talking about critical race theory. Matter of fact, most of them didn't know what it was because you usually see it at the university level. And so, like I said, it's a framework for research. It's usually in higher education, not in K-12. So it was conflated with other issues around reverse racism and things of that nature. And wokeism was something that, as you know, in the early 1900s, things like that, when Black people were traveling through the South, they basically said, stay awake, be woke, stay woke of all the issues that may be going around in the South. And so it has been flipped to something negative and tied to DEI. So, and I'm glad you asked about the definitions, because we conflate all these things strictly around race. So if you mention DEI, the first thing people do is go straight to race. If you mention equity, people go straight to race. And you can't really have any kind of dialogue or conversation if you don't have common language. And so I hope that kind of explains some of it.
Oh, excellent. So why has there been legislative pushback and just outright assault on DEI? And as you address that question, you know, does DEI perpetuate racial stereotyping?
I'm not sure if it, to some degree, I think, because when you use those, that acronym DEI, like I said before, we go straight to race. But if you think about diversity in thought and diversity in other areas, gender identity, things of that nature, it's not just about race. If you think about equity, it's just not about race. We can take race out of the equation and still deal with equity. I'll give you a good example. I can go to Eastern Kentucky and DEI is just as important as it is in Louisville, because you have diverse people in Eastern Kentucky. It may not be diverse in ethnicity, but there's diversity there, right? You want to meet the people's needs, and you want to make sure you have fairness and justice in Eastern Kentucky, right? And you want to make sure they are included in policies and things of that nature. So DEI, you can put that right into a place that's not really diverse from ethnicity, but it still applies to different parts of the country. In reference to policy, you can't put in policy unless you think people are going to adhere to it and feel like that makes sense to them. So outside of Frankfurt, a lot of people don't understand what DEI actually is. And so if you just say enough that it's all about race and it's all about affirmative action, people start to believe that. So when they talk about DEI, they don't think about people with disabilities, right? They don't think about women. They don't think about all these other issues. They just think about race. So they don't think this legislation would impact them, but it actually would in K-12 and higher education and in municipalities and things of that nature. So I think it's just really mostly the way it's been packaged and also a lot of lack of understanding.
So the legislative pushback is because of a lack of understanding, or?
Are you saying the legislative pushback, like supporting DEI, or the lack of support?
Lack of support, you know, because it has existed, but now there's been this all-out assault on it.
Yeah, I think community-wide is just a lack of understanding. It's been packaged that DEI only benefits Black people, and it's reverse discrimination and things of that nature. So it's packaged that way. So people don't really know, then that's all they have, you know, to go on. And so that's how they operate. But you do realize that the anti-DEI legislation, it passed for higher education, but it did not pass for K-12.
The reason I asked the question about perpetuating racial stereotyping, because there's this concern that it is a discriminatory concept to the point where all white people are considered villains. And this is not good for the educational system. It's not fair. It's not right. And, you know, because of that, we need to do away with any of these kind of initiatives.
I can't say I've been to any schools or any classrooms, whether it's K-12. You may see a little bit of that in higher education where they're making white students feel guilty about what has taken place in the past and what's taking place currently. You may see some of that. Somebody just really adamant about their political thoughts. But you don't see that just because you're from a certain part of the state and you live in an all-white community, you're responsible for what happened, you know, the last 60, 70 years. That makes no sense. What we're doing is teaching history, and some people just don't want to hear the history. And I used to have a quote on my wall at EKU that said that ignorance is like sleep. Your initial reaction is get upset at the person who woke you up. And so when you get this new information, and what's happening, Dr. Smith, is a lot of times people are suffering from cognitive dissonance. They've been told this for so many years, right? And then they may go to college or somewhere else, another city, and get this new information. Now they got this weird feeling, this uneasy feeling they have to get rid of. And so they either do one or two things: take that new information and change the way how they interact with people who are not like them, or they're going to go out to social media and find something that confirms what they always believe, which is called confirmation bias. But they're going to get rid of that dissonance one way or the other. And so if you don't teach the history, people don't have that cognitive dissonance. They don't have to feel, you know, that uneasy feeling.
Now, one of the things I want to get to is the fact that you're the CEO of Millennium Consulting Firm that focuses on diversity and equity. You give presentations around the country and lead workshops and so forth. And so how has all of this changed your presentations? How's it affecting your business? Is there still the interest there?
There, it depends on where you go. I still get a lot of calls and things like that, because that's not all I do. But I still get a lot of calls, and I mostly work with K-12 schools and things like that, and most in higher ed. And so if certain groups of students are still not learning, they're occupying the basement of achievement, there's opportunity gaps, they're still trying to figure out what's going on. And a lot of times it's our perceptions of those children. And so they assume that I'm just talking about strictly about race when I discuss it. But yeah, I'm from Southeast Kentucky. And so I can use Appalachia as a way of showing students in Appalachia, regardless of what their ethnicity is, that they are occupying the basement of achievement. They are being left out. Some of them have not been served. And so I can address all children regardless. But in reference to the business and things like that, it's hit a little bit, but there's some people realize that we still have a lot of issues we have to address, particularly in education, and we can't pretend it doesn't exist. And that's just one piece of it. So it's been up and down, but it hasn't been too bad.
All right. Well, that's Dr. Roger Cleveland, a transformational leader, groundbreaking educator, and researcher in the fields of diversity, equity, and cultural humility, and academic innovation. And I'm Gerald Smith with Eastern Standard. Thank you, Dr. Cleveland.
Thank you for the invite.
How do we know how our kids are doing in school compared with kids in other school districts around the country? We've been getting that information from the National Assessment of Educational Progress, also known as NAEP, or the Nation's Report Card. Congress requires that NAEP assess the reading and math skills of fourth and eighth graders every 2 years, and the next test is to happen in the first quarter of 2026. From the 2024 NAEP data, we know, for example, that Kentucky has been making progress coming out of the learning losses of COVID-19, and that Kentucky was one of only 15 states that made some strong gains in fourth grade math. Without this test, we would be pretty much in the dark about how students are faring in American schools. In February, the group that studies the validity of the exams was told to stop working because Education Department funding had been cut off. Now, these are the people with the expertise to ensure the quality and reliability of NAEP. They study whether the questions on the test are measuring skills that matter and if the scores can be trusted. Here to talk with us about the future of NAEP is Jim Cowan, Executive Director of the nonprofit Collaborative for Student Success. He's the guest of Eastern Standard Education contributor Bridget Blom.
Jim, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Bridget. Great to be here.
So, Jim, NAEP is unique because it's not only the gold standard for measuring academic achievement in the U.S., it is the only measure we have for tracking learning progress across time and across the 50 states. What would losing NAEP mean?
Great question. Let me first say that I'm not an expert in NAEP. I am a consumer of all the benefits of NAEP, and I'm a fan. And I'm a fan of NAEP the same way someone might be a fan of getting your cholesterol checked or getting your blood pressure checked. You may not love the results that you're seeing, but you're glad you have the information and you trust the information that you see because you know, because of what stands behind that information, that it's valid and that it's rigorous and that it's understood across many different boundaries and different localities. It's a canary in a coal mine, if you will, for understanding how our kids are doing. Because the way that it is right now, it is a great thing that each state has its own very localized approach to education. But many of the assessments that states use are different. In Kentucky, you use the Kentucky Summative Assessment. Here in Virginia, where I am, we use the Standards of Learning. Other states use a whole series of different tests, and they don't line up perfectly. So if your son or daughter is rated as proficient in fourth grade reading in one state, that may not line up exactly perfectly with what it looks like in another state. Yeah. But NAEP gives you a standard bar across the entire state so you can compare apples to apples. And that's really a huge value to have. So if we lose that capability, we're losing that metric.
We have been using NAEP for 2 to 3 decades now to measure progress in student achievement, to know if we're moving in the wrong direction or we're moving in the right direction. Our state assessments change much more often.
Much more often. Yep.
You can look at urban areas and compare urban areas in Kentucky to other urban areas in Virginia, in California.
And I'll say, Bridget, one of the reasons that my organization became so involved with NAEP was that we were concerned about how many different state assessments there were and the fact that you couldn't always compare which one was which. So we conducted a program called the Honesty Gap, where if we are going to believe, and we do, that NAEP provides that kind of gold standard for where the students are, then we would hope that the state assessment, that the scores wouldn't be too far apart between what you would get in your state assessment compared to what you would get in NAEP. You may not get exactly the same, but let's not have enormous deltas between those different results. That's what we've been doing for the last 6-7 years, is looking at different states and how they line up to NAEP.
So your first Honesty Gap report came out, you say, 5 or 6 years ago,
yeah,
pre-COVID.
2013.
Yeah. Okay. And it helped really shine a light for state policymakers, state education organizations on whether or not the state assessment was living up to what nationally a standard should be.
Exactly. Is the state assessment as rigorous as what NAEP is? And, you know, some people argue like, well, maybe NAEP is too hard. Okay. Let's look at the questions that are asked in the NAEP test compared to the types of proficiency questions that are asked on state tests, and you be the judge. If you're okay, if the state says this is proficient at this level, but NAEP says this is proficient, you tell me if you're comfortable with your fourth grader not being able to have that capability at a certain age.
So you had some states, if I recall from the earlier report, and I'm guessing in the most recent report that came out, you have some states where there's no gap.
Yeah.
So yeah, that might suggest that the NAEP is not too hard.
Yeah, or that they're more rigorous. You know, there were a few states that actually did better than NAEP. There was no state that did that in all of fourth grade reading, fourth grade math, eighth grade reading, eighth grade math. But there were some states that actually showed a lot of very similar results.
So NAEP gives us then a tool to understand how a state is doing relative to other states in the nation. And without NAEP, we are really unable to measure how here in Kentucky we're doing relative to Ohio, relative to Virginia, California. As a parent, we want to know that. We want to know that wherever our young person is being educated, they are well prepared for their future and the ability to compete with young people from other states and arguably other nations.
Absolutely. I mean, as a parent myself, I have 2 daughters, and I want that information. I want to know if we need to get additional assistance or I need to be focusing on, you know, additional tutors or whatever's help that they may need in a certain subject area. I should also say, too, that the reason we call this Honesty Gap is that if there's a big, huge difference, which in some states there were a difference of like 74 percentage points between NAEP and the state test, it tells you that the parents are not probably getting the full picture on how well your kids are doing. Because if you're saying a kid is proficient, but NAEP is telling you that, no, you're like 60 points different than proficient than what we think, something doesn't smell right, right? Like, it's worth investigating what that is. And so, like, we've always encouraged, like, there's no one perfect pill for this in education. You know, like the best thing parents can do is to look at multiple things, right? Of course, you want to talk to your teachers about, is my child on grade level? Is my child performing well on their assessments, on their formative assessments? But also, how do they look? How does my state look on NAEP? What is my honesty gap for my state? There's lots of different things to look at for your kids' healthy education.
So President Donald Trump referenced NAEP in his recent executive order regarding the U.S. Department of Education, and he pointed to the nation failing relative to other nations, and that being the primary reason for his argument that our approach to education needs to change and it needs to all go back to the states. He used NAEP to make that argument. So what does that mean for, you know, the loss of data? And on one side, we've got the president making that argument. On the other side, we're saying without that data, we wouldn't be able to make the argument.
Exactly. There's the irony, right? Like, he used the analytical tool to declare that something wasn't working, and now we're threatening of potentially losing that same analytical tool. So it's kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face a little bit. It's one of the reasons that I think many people, including Secretary Linda McMahon, said in an interview that, you know, she definitely is for having a strong accountability and assessment measurement across the country. And she does like the idea of having that apples to apples look that's provided by NAEP. But she's also not going to promise that we're not going to look at this and maybe find some efficiencies with it or ask some questions. And to that, I say, like, absolutely, we should be doing that. We should always be doing that. But there's an important part to keep the guardrails up. Don't lose the inherent nature of what NAEP provides us, which is that ability to look at long-term data trends to make those kind of tough decisions. I just think it's a bad idea to go to lose that data, to lose that ability to be able to tell what your blood pressure is, tell what your cholesterol level is, so you have that healthy, you know, that health metric for you. But should we look for efficiencies? Absolutely, we should. Always.
So your example is a good one, where Mississippi comes to mind. And frankly, our own story here in Kentucky of being at the bottom of the national rankings in the 1980s. By the mid-2000s, we could show that a state that really failed in literacy rose to 8th in the nation on NAEP by 2015. We've been able to continue to track that celebration of 8th in the nation and then be able to, a couple years ago in 2022, show that we'd fallen back to 29th post-COVID and through the COVID years. In the most recent assessment of NAEP and the reporting, we've been able to say to Kentuckians we've bounced back up to 12th. So it's a sign of where, if for us in the state, it is that temperature check of whether or not we're getting the job done or we're failing in some regard and need to double down and identify successful strategies. Mississippi did the same sort of thing in recent years. It was referred to as the Mississippi Miracle, where they rose from 49th in the nation to 9th. And they were able to point to strategic investments in state-funded pre-K and other policy changes supporting teachers and professional learning in the classroom that resulted in that significant rise. Without NAEP, it's difficult for us to track.
Yeah, I think anyone who is in the business community, the business world, or the military knows full well you get what you inspect and what you measure. And if you don't do that, you're never going to have the full picture. Kentucky's done some excellent work with the Math Achievement Fund and other efforts that you have, but you will never know if those are impactful if you're not measuring the right things around it. And NAEP provides one of those kind of standards that, you know, in conjunction with other tools, can give you that full picture. And it's just really important to have.
So Jim Cowan with the Collaborative for Student Success, author of the most recently released second edition of The Honesty Gap, looking at state assessments relative to NAEP today on Eastern Standard. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Bridget.
Joining us is Larry Pemble, founder of the James Baker Hall Foundation, created to honor the legacy of its namesake, his father, a renowned photographer and former Kentucky Poet Laureate. The foundation's mission is to celebrate the legacy of our great artistic heritage by providing direct support to Kentucky's literary and visual creatives. And it's that support that brings Larry to Eastern Standard today. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Larry.
Tom, thank you very much for having me.
And tell us what drives the James Baker Hall Foundation. What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, we're looking to reward continued excellence in Kentucky letters, which is part of the legacy and the heritage that we inherit here from our forefathers. And we want to ensure that that continues at the same kind of level. And so what we do is find young emerging writers around the state and help them to be all the writers that they can be.
Well, today we're looking into a couple of examples of that mission of support. And first, if you would tell us about the Kentucky on the Road Writers Speaking Tour.
Well, we've designed a tour for the James Baker Hall Book Award winner to travel around the state to the various places literary creatives have accumulated and to present their work and to also participate in identifying young emerging writers who will travel with us and who are local to the area that we are presenting in and help them to hook up with mentors and participate in the literary culture of Kentucky.
You also are supporting something called the Hindman Settlement School Ironwood Writers Studio. Tell us about that.
The Ironwood Writers Studio is the cornerstone of the Young Writers Program at Hindman Settlement School. It's run by Melissa Helton, and it is a summer retreat for Appalachian writers aimed at high school-aged kids. It's kind of a young person's version of the Appalachian Writers Conference, which occurs later on during the summer in Hindman. So the kids come from all over the place. Actually, as a matter of fact, Melissa has students from Virginia, North Carolina, as well as Kentucky, obviously, and West Virginia. And so they are there for a week, and a lot of times this meeting is really transformative for the kids because they meet for the first time, perhaps, other kids who are like them. You know, they're by and large, you know, kind of introverted, you know, right brain thinkers, but they love being together, and that's where art occurs. You know, when artists get together, art happens, you know, and so this is a voice that we think is really critical. And so that we want to support it and make sure that the kids have a chance to be all that they can be.
Larry Pemble, founder of the James Baker Hall Foundation, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog and greeter. You can find all the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.